Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 30th, 1998. In the Creekside Room this evening, we have Bruce Berner. It's session number 98-2 and is titled, Who Killed Princess Di? I accuse you. Let's listen in.
Okay, good evening. My name is Bruce Berner. I teach at the law school at Valparaiso University in Indiana. I teach courses in criminal law and procedure and in evidence, and in a course that law students know as torts, which sounds probably to many of you as if it ought to be a breakfast food, which is just a French word that we use to describe accidents. Torts deals with the general problem of when there is an accident, how do we establish who is liable for it, and who has to pay money damages for it. Most torts cases are called negligence cases. And most of you, I think, are familiar with that term. Automobile collision cases, for example, usually are tried as negligence cases. We don't get many instances of people running their car into people on purpose. That's another kind of tort. That's called an intentional tort. Most of the time when there's a car accident, it's accidental or it's a negligence case. What I want to do tonight is talk about a negligence case that's in the news. It's actually been in the news now since August 31st of last year. And this is in connection with the death of Princess Diana and Dodi Al-Fayed. It's being tried in France, of course, and so it's being tried in a different system from ours. If it were being tried here, a number of things would be different about it. One of them is it wouldn't be as close to ready for trial as it is now, because we take a lot longer to get a case ready for trial than the continental system does. But I'm going to read you a newspaper article here from 2 weeks ago, indicating that they're getting ready to make some decisions there on who may be responsible and who is not responsible for it. But even though it's being tried in France, they have the same core problem that we would have in this case, and that's called the problem of causation. To find somebody liable for a negligence tort, the law requires that you prove four things. The first one is you have to show that a person owed a duty to someone else. But that's, in automobile cases, that's really simple to do. Whenever you get behind the wheel of a car, you owe a duty to anyone who might be in the path. Other pedestrians, other drivers, people in your own car, people in other cars who are passengers. You owe them a duty, and we call that the duty of reasonable care. How much care do you have to use? The law always knows the answer to this. Reasonable care. We'll kind of decide later what exactly reasonable might mean, but mainly, you know, what it is it's a way to give that question to a jury. And we ask the jury, did the defendant act the way the reasonable person would act? And the reasonable person is a fiction, right? He's an ideal person. In fact, the reasonable person was, until the 1960s, called the reasonable man. Okay? And now, of course, if you say reasonable man in the law school, you're going to get sued, right, by the women law students, because they want to know, can't women be reasonable too? And by the way, men, the answer to that question is yes. Right? You never want to get any answer, but yes. Right? So now we talk about the reasonable person. And so what we ask a jury to do is to say, imagine this hypothetical person who is a reasonable person who acts carefully. And now I want you to imagine that that reasonable person is the same age and the same gender and has the same sort of physical disabilities and abilities as the defendant. Now, given that hypothetical person, did the defendant come up to the standard of reasonableness that person would do? Now, law students are agog at this. They ask a million questions about this reasonable person. They're trying to get him or her into their head. They want to know where he lives. Live anywhere, right? Juries are not confused. It's an amazing thing. Juries know who the reasonable person is. Who is it?
Them.
What would I have to do? If this person wasn't as careful as I had been, then that person's negligent. And then I sort of don't like that person and I want to make him pay because he was careless, he was negligent, he was reckless. We have a million words for it, right? But if they say, boy, that person didn't do anything wrong, I can see myself acting in precisely the same way, that's their cue to vote for the defendant, right? Because if this is what they would do, they translate that as reasonable. Actually, it's kind of interesting because they may start out thinking they would or would not act this way, but juries have to go back into the jury room and talk to each other. And that's one of the most powerful thing about the jury dynamics. I think juries would be terrible if we just sent them back into the room, they all hear the case, now vote, majority wins, don't bother talking about it, that just takes time, right? 7-5 for the plaintiff, case over. Now, we've always required this unanimous or near unanimous verdict, and part of the purpose of that is to force these people to talk their way through it. In addition to duty, you have to prove that the duty was breached, and that's what we call negligence. Right? That's the carelessness or recklessness. We also have to prove damage. There's no tort case unless somebody's hurt. You have to have compensable damage. Right? If I'm careless, then trip and fall here, and I just touched your sneaker, okay? And I was negligent because you shouldn't have walked towards someone and tripped them, right? You can't sue me. I had a duty. I was careless, but there's no damage. There's nothing to compensate.
So if I was a fragile individual, let's say I'm a fragile individual.
You have some disease where when someone touches your sneaker, you get ill for 30 days. I am responsible. Okay? Then there is damage. Okay? There are some torts that we don't need damage for, but they're not negligent torts, they're intentional torts. Things like libel and slander and assault and battery, where we make me pay because it's just wrong to do those things, but they're intentionally bad. But for negligence, we want to require, before we take money out of my pocket and put it into yours, that there's something to compensate. That leaves us the last element, the one that we're going to concentrate on tonight, and that's the trickiest of all. That is causation. In other words, what the plaintiff has to prove is that the defendant's carelessness caused my damage. And I try to get the students thinking right away when you say that one thing caused another thing, our whole life, we just take that for granted. That's the easiest thing in the world. He hurt me, that he caused my injury. She caused this. It turns out what caused what is one of the most complicated questions in philosophy, in history, and in law. So, who caused the death of Princess Diana? Let's get some candidates up here. I want most of you folks know the basics of the story. Who would you nominate? Yeah.
The driver.
Henri Hall, I think his name was. Driver of the car, and what, from what you've heard about the case, what did he do that was negligent?
Specifically, he drove into a pillar. He was speeding.
Drinking.
He was.
So we got.
Reportedly had a high alcohol content.
Might have been driving drunk. These are all things, of course, at the trial that have to be proved. But we're just dealing tonight with theories. What sort of theories do you have to even make a case? We know that you're going to have to prove these things. But at least the reports tend to indicate that he was speeding, that he had been drinking. Okay. Anything else?
Well, the city of Paris itself because of the roads.
City of Paris. Ooh. A lovely defendant. One of the great things about that, you know, lawyers don't look for defendants that have some money.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Okay.
So, that's always a nice thing. Mm-hmm. City of Paris.
They were negligent in care of the roads or whatever.
What was wrong with the roads?
I don't have a slice idea, but Sam's going to find out.
Yeah. it turns out there was something terribly wrong with the roads.
Really?
The passageway through the tunnel had pillars. And as I recall, 40 40-foot intervals. And the roadway, there's two lanes under the tunnel, and here's the roadway. The wall is here on the outside of the pillar. So we have three pillars here, and they're just exposed. It would be as if you put the telephone poles right against the side of the pavement. And in some places in the country, they are to the side of the pavement, right? But this is a city, and this is a high-speed road, and this has a lot of traffic. In most places in the United States, if you had this set up, you would have a deflecting, some kind of deflecting mechanism here.
It's a tunnel, so it's more than dark.
That's right. And, you know, half the lights don't work. Mm-hmm. You know, there used to be lights, but they're sort of on and they're sort of not on. So we can talk about whether or not there should have been a deflecting mechanism there, or guardrails, what we usually would use. The fellow who did the engineering on this, who went over there and measured this, is a guy named Byron Block. And Byron Block worked with us on a case against the Ford Motor Company back in 1980, a case involving the Pinto that some of you may have heard. Mm-hmm. Well, he's an automotive safety expert. And what he determined is that if there had been guardrails there, the car might have collided with it. But we don't get anything like the collision we had there, because we don't get the quick stop from the pillar. What we get is a deflecting accident with some injuries, certainly not that. Because that guardrail takes you and then you spin out. If you have a guardrail on this side, you might hit some other cars and other things, but by that point you're losing speed. The city of Paris, now we can talk about them in terms of road conditions. Anybody else? Any other candidates?
Possibly one of the passengers. Because they were, chauffeur was hired for them, so if they were to give instructions to go faster than they would.
Okay. The passengers themselves may have caused damage. What's the problem with them as defendants?
They're dead.
You know, they're not only dead, they're the plaintiffs, basically. Right? They're the people who are seeking the damage. But sometimes people cause their own problems. And sometimes if the reason you were hurt is because of something negligent that you did, then you're negligent. Does that mean you can't recover? No. It turns out it doesn't mean you can't recover, because what we're going to do, at least what we do in this country, is we take all the negligence in the case and we divide it into 100%. And so if you're the defendant and you hurt me and I'm the plaintiff and I'm negligent and you're negligent and the jury finds that, then the jury's going to be asked what percentage negligence belongs to Bruce and what percentage negligence belongs to the defendant. And if the defendant, let's say they find you 70% negligent, what do I get? I get 70% of my damages. In other words, my damages, whatever they are, I have to prove those, medical expenses, pain and suffering, they're reduced by the amount of my damage. But it's certainly possible in this case that the passengers may have been giving directions to go faster to the driver.
Yeah, but that's something that cannot be determined, because they're dead. There's one survivor. He had a head injury. He has no memory.
Right. That's a great point. And what it shows is that you can have all the theory in the world, but cases depend on facts. And when you don't have them, you don't have them. And in this case, there's no way to get them. So you have to deal with the facts you have and piece it together the best you can.
In this case, though, that man who did survive, it was his responsibility to be looking out for their personal safety. So he's obviously negligent. He's in a car with a drunken driver. It's his responsibility to protect her physically.
Okay, help me with the fourth person in the car.
The bodyguard, the one who survived with the head injuries.
Okay, so that's a bodyguard.
That's why he's in the car.
And he's in the car with him. He's in the front passenger side? Okay. Yeah,
and he's there for their safety.
That's right.
That's his purpose.
Body.
Well, we don't know that. I mean, he may be there to push away the photographers. It's not clear to me
what his function really is.
I don't know what his function. I don't know why he was hired, what his job description is.
We don't know that, but we could find that out. If it were a real case, we could find out what they were. But it sounds, doesn't it, like it ought to include taking care of them, looking out for their personal safety from sort of any sorts of threats, whether those threats be photographers or others or drivers. One of the things, of course, that's hard to know is, did the bodyguard know the driver was drunk? It's hard to know. We don't know if he knew that. The only one who can tell us that is him. We have some reasons not to be too willing to trust the things he tells us if they're things like, I had nothing to do with this, right? On the other hand, we don't have any, at least I don't think we have any better evidence. But if he's the bodyguard, the driver gets in the car, he doesn't know the driver's drunk, then it's hard to saddle him with the drunkenness. It might be, though, that he should have said something about the speed.
Maybe he did.
Maybe
we don't know.
Maybe he did.
Maybe he said slow down. Maybe he said speed up.
Maybe they're so used to going that fast he didn't even think about it.
Or maybe Princess Di was saying, get us away from here, speed up.
Why, were they in a hurry?
They were trying to lose the paparazzi, right?
The
paparazzi.
Should we put them up there?
Sure.
Let's put them up there.
I forgot that. And then there's supposedly, I don't know if there's any truth to this one, but there was evidence there may have been another car there, too, that had been checking paint
and that sort of thing
that left the scene.
Right. And we don't know the status of that investigation. See, the wonderful thing about the Continental Systems is once the case starts, they don't tell you anything until they're ready. And when the press comes and says, tell us, I think they kill the press. I don't know what they do, but the press doesn't bother them once the case is in process. This is about the first thing, this article here is about the first thing that we got, and only because there was a court hearing. Up until the time there's a court hearing, we don't hear from it.
I have a question about listing the paparazzi there. So you're saying if I am attempting to follow you, and if in this country that's legal, you're a public figure and I'm a photographer, and you injure yourself in trying to get away from me when I'm doing something legal, I'm at fault?
That's the question.
Yeah, that's...
Okay, who wants the other side of that?
We don't know what they were doing either. There's all kinds of theories that have swirled around that the paparazzi may have been flashing light bulbs and blinding them and might actually have the paparazzi, no, at the side. Thanks, Ira.
Okay, that's a different kind of claim, right? If we can show that the photographers, the paparazzi, or the motorcycle person sort of caused the accident by blinding them or getting in their way or driving them off the road, that's a different sort of causation. That's more direct. But what if what happened is, what a lot of people suspect, they're in pursuit because they want the pictures, because Princess Di is the biggest story in the world, right, at that time. They don't want to have their picture taken, and so they try to get away from them. They go faster, the paparazzi go faster, and you get this. My question is, in a chase, who really governs the speed? The car in the back or the car in the front?
Front, of course.
Huh? Yeah.
Front.
It's an interesting problem, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm uncomfortable with having the paparazzi there, too, because back to your reasonable person standard, the reasonable person is not going to speed in a tunnel because they're being followed by somebody.
That might be. Yeah,
that's a picture.
Yeah, I mean if I'm being followed by a tank and somebody's going to flash my car, then heck.
I agree with you,
camera.
I agree with you 100%, but come with me one more step. What you're saying is, you don't think the driver of the front car was careful enough.
That's right.
Okay, and I'm saying, good, I'll give you that. I want to know about the people who are chasing them. I want to know if you think they fell below the standard of ordinary care. Because they can both be negligent, and they can both be the cause. Do reasonable people follow others trying to take their picture?
In a high-speed chase, I don't think so.
Yeah, see, that's what begins to garble it up. We have a lot of people doing things that aren't necessarily reasonable. Yes.
Another possible candidate is, I think, Dodie. He's the boss of Henry Paul. But the thing was, right. He said lose him or speed up.
Right.
The thing is Henry's job was to transport them from A to B. And if you're going over 80, there's lots of room for error and accidents. And Henry, as a hired chauffeur, should realize his job is also to get them to point B in one piece. And if he exceeds the limits and leaves all this room, one bounce off the wall and they flip.
Right.
So I think him as the driver, he went over what he could do. I think he got out of control. And also when his boss, Dodie, if indeed he told him, lose him, Henry should know his limits. He should have full control of that vehicle. And also, what's wrong with tinted windows and maybe going the speed that you want to? Let the paparazzi do what they want. Continue on your way, doing your job down the road.
Yeah. Response.
Well, there was tinted windows. That wasn't the issue.
Yeah, there were tinted windows.
Right. And the issue isn't so much that they're going to be taking pictures in the car, it's where their destination is. That's where the paparazzi wants to get to. That's why they're following them.
Yeah, and where is Princess Di going with this guy who is a Muslim? I mean, that's a big deal scandal.
And as a photographer, they have a right to make a living. In my living, I'm paid for the pictures that I deliver of these two together. I mean, that's going to be part of the other part.
It would seem more like, in response to that, Dodie is more responsible for what's happening because he's employing the driver, he's employing the bodyguard. You know, he's the guy who's calling the shots. It's just like the executive at Ford or some company that says, go ahead and build a Pinto this way.
Right.
Then maybe the lowly engineer who's saying, hey, there's a problem here.
Actually, he's not hired by Dodie. He's actually hired by Dodie's father, I thought.
But my guess is with instructions to take direction from Dodie.
I don't know if this is a shed liner. I'm sorry, go ahead and finish.
I like your argument a lot. The one problem that the lawyers are going to run into with it is how much independent judgment can a driver in the employ of someone that powerful actually be expected to exercise? You could say, look, I'm the driver, I'm not taking directions from you. To which they say, you're not taking paychecks from us either. Unless the only cases where that becomes more difficult is if the person in the position of the driver is a professional, say like a doctor, where when the hospital says to the doctor, don't do the operation this way, we order you to do it that way, that's where the doctor has a separate responsibility not to follow those directions. But ordinary employees, that's real tricky.
What's the line there? Because, I mean, I'm thinking of other cases where, you know, the head finance guy says to Chris Brooks, everybody, you know, doesn't, you know, and the people underneath who go along with it, they're equally, they can be equally penalized.
Well,
you know, they're not off the hook just because.
Right. No, that's correct. And we have to make a real broad distinction here between criminal cases and civil cases. Because in criminal cases, the defense, he told me to do it, is usually referred to as the Eichmann defense.
Sure.
Doesn't work, right? The superior orders defense has generally been rejected in almost all cultures. So if the activity you're doing is criminal, you can't defend it on the ground that you were directed to do it. But if it only gives civil liability, you get some protection. In fact, what happens is the negligence of an employee is imputed to and becomes the negligence of the employer, and the employer has to pay.
Is that what happened in Morton Thiokol with the shuttle explosion?
Yes.
There were engineers who knew this wasn't a safe launching,
right.
Or they were afraid it wasn't.
Right.
the company got stuck.
Yeah.
Going back to the, you know, who's the cause here, the lead car, the chase car situation. What would have happened if the photographers, the paparazzi, crashed and somebody died as they're chasing these people at high speed?
Great question. What if the people who crash are the paparazzi? Do they have a lawsuit now against the front car for going too fast?
Mm-hmm.
One's probably going to run aground on the ground. Why do you have to keep up with it?
Economics. Huh? It's my living. I'm supposed to do that.
Well,
so we should blame the tabloids that employ the paparazzi.
Now you get
and close. Then. After you blame the tabloids, who hire the paparazzi?
The readers, the people who pay for it.
Guilty.
Right, that's why I titled this, Who Killed Princess Diana, I Accuse You, because if there were no market for the pictures, then nobody would be struggling to get the pictures. There wouldn't be this kind of money in the photographer. So we can, at least under ordinary principles of causation in fact, say everybody who reads tabloids. Is some part of the cause here. It's a little bit like the debate about people who wear fur. I mean, who is it that they target? They target the user of the fur. Now, the user isn't going out into the wild and hunting and trapping and killing, but the thought there is, if the user didn't exist, the market wouldn't exist, the other people don't go and do this for sport. They do it because there's a market for it. And it's like the alligator bags, and there's a lot of different examples where there's a sense in which the end user is a big cause here. So the paparazzi thing is a real strange legal issue in terms of causation. This whole business of the chase is very interesting. It gets into notions of privacy. It's all charged with whether we like very much what the paparazzi are doing, whether we, even though it is their job, there is economics, there's something about it that many people find to be pretty seedy.
But then why do they buy the newspapers with the pictures? That's their argument.
That all turns on who they are, and it's not the same they necessarily, but, I think mainly because most of us are schizophrenic. We want a lot of things, but we don't want to find out what it took to get them.
Sure.
To us, and we'd rather stay as blind to that as we possibly can. Dave Barry, in one of his columns, gives us the definition of paparazzi. In case you don't know, the Italian papa meaning photographer, razzi meaning who are vermin. Okay, but that's his take on the whole thing, and that is that he just doesn't like what they're doing, and so they should be responsible. What you have to prove here, yes, sir.
Oh, I was just two things. I know this very issue right now is there were congressional hearings on it recently. Paul Reiser and a few other, Michael J. Fox. So it's actually this issue
right.
Is
on privacy and the photographers are getting their face in this and that. They're trying to sponsor some legislation that will create a certain amount of space so that the photographers can't get within X feet of people if they're not in a public engagement. And that's the key problem, you know. If they're performing, then you can cover. But if they're going out to dinner with their spouse, then they're looking for some kind of protection. That's the problem with celebrity, isn't it? Is that it doesn't really ever end.
And the other question was the driver hired, or was he working for a certain chauffeur company?
He appears to have been directly employed by the Fayed family. He worked in the hotel, he worked in a number of places, but driver was one of the folks. What they're doing now, there's just some interesting things from the article here. Including, I had a lot of really juicy quotes about what people are saying about all this. Many close to the case predict the photographers will soon be exonerated. So the court is holding hearings now, but it looks like they're going to say that the causal effect of the paparazzi is too remote, too indirect. Too many other things happened in between, and so while it may be that a lot of people are very upset with the paparazzi, it looks like they're going to cut them loose from the case. Henri is still being held in as a defendant. the city of Paris is not a defendant because under French law, they can't be a defendant. That's a whole different sort of problem. It's very different in this country. Dodi's father says, this is a report that the paparazzi are about to be cut loose from the lawsuit. If I was not in a courtroom, I would hang them all. The immorality, the inhumanity of what they did, they were like vultures around the bodies. That's an interesting question.
But that's after the accident.
Yeah, it's after the accident. In other words, what people do and how little respect they show people after they're dead is not truly relevant. It's not, well, let's put it this way, it's not legally relevant to whether or not they caused the accident. But is it morally relevant? If you were the paparazzi and the defendant, you wouldn't want the jury to learn this. You wouldn't want the jury to learn how bad they were after the death, would you?
No.
Because even though the jury will be told that's not legally relevant, juries know better than what the judges instruct them sometimes.
But is that the kind of case that they're going to have in France? I'm kind of confused by it because I'm used to our system.
Right.
So
right.
I was under the impression that this may never even go before a jury. It may just be decided by magistrates over there or something like that.
Yes.
And
a panel.
Do they believe in joint liability or joint negligence the way
correct.
We do in our case?
They will not use a jury for this. This will be done by a panel of legal experts. In fact, the same people who investigated will decide it. So it's a very, very different, very, very different system. But they're still required to if they're going to find someone liable, they must find they caused it.
Mm.
So now let's get back to what that means. What does it mean legally when we say someone caused something? This is where I want you to look at the yellow sheet here, if you would. A poisons B, and B dies within several minutes. A V never fares well in these examples. V stands for victim, and he's always getting hurt or killed or something. V's enemy, B, comes upon V's body an hour later. And believing V is only sleeping, shoots V. Who caused V's death? A or B?
Probably C.
And it's always C.
It's B. B shouldn't have been so many enemies.
What?
B, he shouldn't have made so many enemies.
Yeah, A appears pretty clearly to be the cause, right?
Mm-hmm.
B would have been the cause. In other words, if it were true that the victim was sleeping, then B would have caused his death by shooting him. But one rule we can extract from number one is that the law cares about who did cause it, not who might have caused it. In other words, we're worried about an empirical reality, what happened. It might be that you're very negligent, and I'm only a little negligent. But if my little negligence is the only thing that caused the death, I'm on the hook. Even though you had a lot of negligence, if you didn't cause it, you're off the hook. A invites V into A's house and gives V a cup of coffee with poison in it. They talk for a few minutes, and then V raises the cup to his lips to drink. Just then, V is struck and killed by a bullet whizzing through the window. The shot had been fired by B. Who caused V's death?
B.
Right? A was about to. A was even trying to. Right? Just so you can tell people you got a lot of legal vocabulary when you were up here. The second case is called a case of preemptive causation. That is, the first cause looks like it's going to cause something, and then it gets preempted by something else, which steps in independently and causes it. The first case is called a case of precluded causation. In other words, what A did made it impossible for B to cause B's death later because A had already produced it. So those two are pretty straightforward. But let me ask you this. How did you go about arriving at the right answer? What kind of mental process did you go through to decide that it was A in the first case and B in the other?
Just decide at what point is the person dead. And then just look at the facts on either side. Well, the circumstances on either side.
Okay, so you fixed on the time of death. And you fixed on what the sheet said the manner of death was, and then you kind of reasoned back.
Yeah,
back and forward.
I think if I were a juror and you know, didn't have this information, I would listen real carefully to what the coroner said. Mm-hmm. If the coroner told me the cause of death was poisoning,
right.
The cause of death was a gunshot wound.
Absolutely. And in fact, you can't do causation in a death case unless you know the manner of death. If you can't find out what the manner of death was, you can't begin. Okay? But here we're assuming we get pretty good information about that. Now, number three is going to introduce a worse problem.
Then did A, in that situation, not commit a crime? It's a little slightly different question.
Oh, yeah, it is. And the answer is A did commit a crime, and if we're worried about the criminal side, that's where we get into attempt and those kind of things.
Right.
But to have a completed crime or to have a compensable tort, we need to have causation. And you're absolutely right. That's a good point. On the criminal side, sometimes even when there's no causation, we might have a crime like conspiracy or attempt or solicitation to commit a crime, which don't require any actual causation at all. Right. Yes, sir?
Well, I don't want to jump the subject too much. I have a sister who's a police officer. Uh-huh. She has a story about a drive-by shooting. A fellow shooting over the top of the car, shoots the driver accidentally, and then the car crashes, so they're able to apprehend him. Mm-hmm. So he's guilty of manslaughter, it turns out.
Who is?
The shooter. Mm-hmm. Because he wasn't trying to kill the driver.
He killed his own driver?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shot down into the...
Yeah, it was an accident.
Right. but he surely, the shooter certainly is the cause of the accident,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. You get into different questions there about whether or not that's privileged. And sometimes when the police try to stop someone, it of course is privileged because they have the power to make an arrest. Then you get into questions about whether that was too much force or not, but assume we get past that. There's no question but that that's what caused it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Look at number three. Assume that 1,000 cubic feet of a particular toxic discharge would effectively kill Lake Bob, i.e. would kill all plant and animal life and render the lake useless, would pollute it in effect. Company A and Company B each discharge 2,000 cubic feet of this toxin into Lake Bob. Who polluted Lake Bob?
Both.
That's the obvious answer.
Both is one answer. May I have another one?
Does it matter who did it first?
It sure does. What if we can prove...
It doesn't tell that.
What if we can prove that Company A did it 2 weeks before Company B?
That's it.
Then do you notice that it simply becomes the same as hypothetical one?
Mm-hmm.
Because the pollution, like death, has already occurred before Company B has acted.
No, it's somewhat different. From the aspect of needing to remove toxins from the environment, there's suddenly twice the amount of toxins there. Because pollution is a reversible process, death is not.
So far as we know.
As far as we know.
So, yes, that's why I wanted to build into this the idea that a certain number of cubic feet would kill the lake. That's the damage we want, is the death of the plant life now. It is true we might bring that lake back later, but the what's irreversible is the temporary loss of plant life, right? Okay. But you're right. In that sense, it's different. But if we're only looking at the temporary damage, then it's the same as number one. Four, same as three, except that each company discharged 600 cubic feet. Who polluted Lake Bob? Remember, it takes 1,000 cubic feet to pollute it. Now they each pour 600 in. Oh, by the way, let's go back to three for just a second. What happens if the evidence won't tell us who polluted it first?
Which it doesn't.
Which often it doesn't, which we don't know. Then the law is they're both causes. And we don't want to say they're equally liable. That may depend on a lot of other factors, but they're both causes, certainly.
Well, I'm thinking of those EPA law, the toxic site lawsuits.
Right. Tough cases because it's very tough to show the source in many of those.
And who's those? I would think at that time it would be hard to show.
It's very hard to show. The state of the law on environmental torts now is the laws tend to try to relax the amount of proof that you need because it's so difficult to get that proof and trace it back. If any of you ever want to read a wonderfully written book which tells the story of trying to go through an environmental lawsuit of this type involving a real case out in Woburn, Massachusetts, a book called A Civil Action by Jonathan Haar, H-A-R-R. It's a wonderfully written book. Once you read the book, if you were a lawyer, you would never take one of these cases because it just showed, it just basically disintegrated this poor man's life who tried to bring it because you're fighting all of these giant conspiracies who won't let you get at the fact.
Does the law care if the discharge is intentional versus negligent versus accidental?
It cares, but it doesn't care in connection with the question of causation. Okay. That would matter up here with reach, etc. And I want part out of the way and just talk about what we mean when we say that one thing causes another. What would you do in case four then? They each throw 600 feet at you.
At the same time?
Yeah, roughly the same time, or at least one after the other in such a way that they combine. And now we get them both, right? Right. Now I want to stop and tell you the way the law at least tries to approach what's called causation in fact. They approach it, I think, not the way a scientist would, because scientists' requirements for causation are much tighter, and they require a lot of repeatability, except many of these things we can't repeat legally anyway. But more the way a historian would, and here's the question the law asks, and it adopts the test here. The test is sine qua non. Isn't that wonderful? You want to know why lawyers get $100 an hour rather than $50 an hour? Is they know the Latin, right? Sine qua non, which means, we got any Latin scholars here? Without which, not. Which means something is a cause and fact under these circumstances. Imagine the same case, and now imagine the defendant away. Imagine that the defendant did not do what he did. If the same result would have occurred, then that looks as if the defendant is not a cause. Go back to problem one. A poisons B and dies within several minutes. B's enemy B comes upon B's body an hour later. Believe B is only sleeping, shoots B. Who caused B's death? Let's test for B. If B hadn't done anything, would the death still have occurred?
Yes.
Absolutely. The facts basically tell us he's irrelevant. If A hadn't done anything, would the victim still have would the victim have died at the same time?
No.
He would have died later.
Yeah.
Right. And I once had a student say, "Oh no, you can't say that. You can't say he caused the death. All he did was shorten his life." And it took a few seconds, and I let that happen. You know, I let the rest of the class figure out that shortening life and causing death are really pretty much the same thing, right? So we can show he shortened the life, therefore he caused the death. Five is a very common kind of problem. I don't mean the strange facts in five happen all the time. They hardly ever happen, I would hope. But it's a very common kind of fact pattern. A bumps into V, knocking V off the roof of a 100-story skyscraper. B, a resident of floor 79, is sitting in his apartment carelessly cleaning his gun, and a discharge is sending a bullet out the window into the plummeting V, killing him instantly. Who caused V's death?
B.
Yeah, B, because I say killing him instantly, so the coroner, you always want to hear from medical examiner, right? Because we need to know manner of death to make any sense of this. So the coroner says, died from gunshot. This is a great coroner, by the way, who can determine this after a 100-story truck. This is a really good coroner.
Although you don't want to deal with the issue of negligence, mm-hmm. even though I may be careless in cleaning my gun, if I live on floor 79 and shoot a shot out the window, it's reasonable for me to assume that no one's going to be dropping it.
But the law is never reasonable.
Oh, hold on. No, sometimes. 10% of the time, the law is reasonable. You interest me, Dee. You're absolutely right, but let me try this. where you want to make that argument.
Right, I understand that. Right? And you don't want to deal with that.
Yeah, yeah, but that's where you would make your argument.
Yes.
You're saying it's just not negligent to shoot out a 79-story window because people don't fall by every day. I guess he was dropping in. The other place that we would argue that is when we get to the next issue, which we wouldn't have time for tonight, but there's another aspect of causation that says, even though you caused it, in fact, if you're not the proximate cause, and now we're getting into some real weasel words here, and what they say is, if what you caused was not foreseeable, it was indirect, there were other things in between there, no one in their right mind could have foreseen this, the defendant might get off. But what you fall into there is what almost every law student falls into at first. When we teach this stuff, we have to take each element out and look at it by itself. But what you're reacting to is the whole case. What you're saying is he shouldn't be liable. But what the law student can't do is to let that affect his or her understanding of this. And they always say, well, that bothers me. And they go, yeah, okay, look over here, look up here. We'll make what bothers you go away when we get to some of the other things that have to be shown. But in this case, they both caused. If the guy hadn't shot out the window, he wouldn't be dead at the moment he was dead. And of course, if he hadn't been bumped off the roof, he couldn't be there to be shot. So this is a case that we call combined cause, or sequenced cause, where two people cause something by setting up a chain reaction. I bump into you, and that causes you to bump into them. Or I shoot you, right? Your police officer example. The police officer shoots the driver of a car because they want to arrest him. The car spins out and kills a pedestrian. The police officer caused the death of the pedestrian. Because he caused the thing that caused the death of the pedestrian. We begin to look at it all the way down the line. The sine qua non test, right? Or law students call it what? But for, right? Yeah, but for test. Which is nice, good old English, $25 an hour. It's an interesting way of analyzing the case, but let me suggest that there's something vaguely troubling about it. Because what it asks the jury to do is to imagine what would have happened if something else hadn't happened. And I want to suggest to you that that's one of the most difficult things on the face of the earth to know. To know what would have happened if something else hadn't happened. We call this the problem of the counterfactual, right? You have to make what's called a counterfactual inquiry. You have to assume that something isn't true, which is, and then you have to speculate. What else? What other word could we use? Here's one of my favorite examples. A little girl who likes to watch the sky notices that at least certain times during the year, at a particular time in the evening, the constellation Orion appears. And she knows where about in the sky it will appear on each night, knows it travels a little bit differently each night, but can identify it and knows that it appears. She also knows that every time she has seen the constellation Orion, 20 minutes later, the Big Dipper pops into view. And this happens every time. And so she concludes that Orion causes the Big Dipper. That the appearance of Orion causes the Big Dipper. Is she right or is she wrong? Start with that.
She's wrong.
She's wrong. Okay. Why?
It's an unmeasured third variable called the rotation of the Earth that's causing both.
Yeah, in other words, we would say that she's making an informal fallacy. Her logic is bad. She's attributing cause and effect to two things which are really two effects of some third cause. Mm-hmm. That's why I put on the poster here, does high school cause college?
Right, yeah.
Well, high school comes before college.
Yeah.
How about do good high school grades cause good college grades?
No.
No.
No, they're both caused by a student having a particular aptitude and a particular interest, and thus they do well in both. So that unmeasured third cause is there. Now, how would the law determine whether the little girl is right? The law would say, let's imagine a night where Orion doesn't appear. That's the way you make the counterfactual inquiry, right? You imagine away the hypothetical cause, okay? And then what? Well, then I assume we say, well, then the Big Dipper will appear. And that proves it. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm not sold. If Orion doesn't appear, I'm getting out of here. Right? Something pretty strange is going on, and I have no idea what it is. So a lot of times, while this sounds real easy, and in some cases it works pretty well, a lot of other times it just leaves you right where you were at the beginning, and that is guessing what we mean when we say that one thing causes another. Number six is probably the most famous causation hypothetical in law schools. It was thought up by a scholar named H.L.A. Hart, I think in the 30s, and law students have been struggling to understand this one ever since. A prospector, P, goes out into the desert with 6 days of water in his canteen. While he is sleeping during night three, and at his furthest point from civilization, X poisons all the water in P's canteens. Several hours later, and before P wakes up, Y, working wholly independently from X, pours out all the contents of the canteen into the sink. P awakes to find he is out of water and dies 2 days later during a frantic attempt to find it. Who caused P's death? And what I'm not going to do is ask you to solve that. I'm going to ask you to sort of think about it.
It's the same thing as the other ones. If the cause of death is thirst rather than poison, then it's...
Interesting. In other words, you went to the manner of death.
Right.
In other words, what you... And that's what Hart wants you to do there.
Well,
you,
I think it's a combination of the manner and the timing. That, first of all, I mean, he didn't die of poisoning. He died of thirst.
So he died later.
He died later.
So
and he didn't die of poison because he never took the poison. It was dumped out before.
So the guy who poured it out did him a favor.
But we aren't. We don't know if the guy who poured it out was intending to do him a favor. We don't know if he didn't know if it was poison or not. He could have been trying to kill him by just making him die of thirst.
But it looks to me like he lengthened his life because it takes longer to die from thirst than from poison.
But what are we trying here? Whether he's dead or whether he lives 3 days longer?
We're trying to figure out who causes death.
He died because he had no water.
What if the second guy hadn't come along and the prospector woke up and determined that the water was poison? What would he have died of?
Thirst.
Yes. Thirst. Yeah, see, that's the problem. It is at least possible.
Right.
That the first person could kill him through the cause of thirst. In fact, here's another way to think about it. What is it that the second guy poured out onto the sand?
Poison.
And that's all. There's a sense in which there's no water left. Once the water is mixed with the poison, it's lost its only life-giving capacity. It is just poison at that point.
Mm.
And that's what the second guy pours out, not knowing he does, of course. That problem. Let's leave you with number eight here.
So what's the answer?
The answer is no one has any clue. And what it tells us is causation, finally, is a highly philosophic notion. And lawyers argue about it all the time, especially when we get down here to proximate cause. My guess is you make the best case in six for both of them. You probably make a fairly good case for both.
That they were both jointly negligent?
That they are both causes.
X or Y would be...
Does it attempt to figure in on this at all?
Not at the causation level. Not at the causation level. It fits in up here. If we're in a criminal case, of course, we have to prove it.
So that's really, you take it to the next step. You say they're jointly, but then you try to knock it out at the point of negligence or intent.
Right.
What is proximate cause? Just a quick definition so we know what we're leaving out here.
You betcha. That's number eight. That's okay. why I wanted to leave you at number eight. Frank and Frieda Fertel, who already have eight children, decide that eight is enough. And Frank has a vasectomy performed by Dr. Snipper. A year later, Frank sires the couple's ninth child, Freddie. The evidence will clearly show that Dr. Snipper negligently performed the procedure. When Freddie is 8 years old, he burns down Farmer Fanny's barn. Fanny sues Dr. Snipper, claiming, in effect, that had Dr. Snipper performed the procedure properly, her barn would still be standing because Freddie would never have been born. Do you think she should win this lawsuit? If not, why? I'll show you something. The doctor had a duty to perform the negligent properly, the operation properly. The doctor was negligent. He clearly did not perform the operation properly. Fanny Farmer's barn is damaged. It's destroyed. Causation, cause and fact, sine qua non, counterfactual inquiry. Let's try to imagine what would have happened if the doctor had acted properly. There's a vasectomy. There's no birth. The barn's standing. A lot of speculation, but fairly simple speculation compared to some of these other cases, right? No kid, no barn burning, right? Doctor is a cause and fact. Where that case is going to fall apart is under some doctrines that are hidden here under this rubric called proximate cause, in which we say, even though you might be a cause in fact, it has to be close enough in time and effect, or at some point it becomes unjust to let causation string out too long.
That would make all parents of any...
Right.
Sure.
That's the Adam and Eve theory. That's why I say Adam and Eve cause it hadn't been for them.
Right.
This wouldn't have happened. None of this would have happened. So that's what proximate cause is. It limits the liability for even actual causes to those who are within a reasonably foreseeable period of time and a reasonably foreseeable manner.
Reasonably foreseeable is left general. So there again, it's the reasonable man kind of reasonable person theory that falls.
Yes, and I can also tell you that the yes I just gave you, we spent approximately 18 class hours to get to that sort of general yes, because there's a lot of little thickets in there, but that's the basic idea.
There are time frames that have come into.
Yeah, there are time frames, there's some statutes that affect it, there's a direct and indirect causes, and they work differently. There's certain kind of funny little rules, the rule called the hemophilia rule. If I hurt you, and you have some kind of a pre-existing condition, And so that your injuries are just way beyond anything I could imagine. I cut you and you bleed to death.
Right.
I'm responsible for all of that. I'm considered a proximate cause of all of your damage. But that's kind of an exception to the usual rule about proximate cause. Thank you all. I think I have to let you go for respers.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.